Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of High Resolution, Bite Size Video Game Industry Podcast. Today we are joined by Julian from Massive Monster of Cult of the Lamb fame and recent acclaim. Firstly, congratulations on the launch and congrats on the early success of the game, Julian. It must be quite the thrill for the team.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been absolutely crazy. Like, I think it's just kind of, it just continues to like break our expectations of what's going on with it. So yeah, been loving it.
Fantastic. So I want to take things back a little bit to start things off. Julian, do you recall the moment when you decided to work in video games?
I think I was kind of came across kind of randomly, but me and my friend were playing this like weird game. I can't remember what it was. It was some like online kind of game, but it like had really simple graphics and stuff. But I could see like that you could go into the source files and kind of change all the graphics. So yeah, I just kind of came across and I was like, oh, we can just go in here and change the graphics. That's awesome. So me and my friend were kind of playing around with that. And then we're like, this is great. Why don't we make our own game? That could be fun. So yeah, we started on it. My friends, I think, immediately gave up. But then yeah, I just kept doing it, and yeah, that was maybe, I don't know, 12-14 years ago, so here we go.
Oh, fantastic. And I know that you had a little bit of a grounding in the flash game scene back in the day, which was a bit of a hive of activity for a lot of developers in their early days. How did you get started with the flash game development, or what drew you to that side of things?
Yeah, so the flash games, I think I was hanging out on like Newgrounds and, you know, all those websites and playing a bit of flash games. So yeah, I was definitely kind of getting in the community of it. And so yeah, I kind of downloaded Flash and I was like, oh, what's this about? And yeah, I started playing around with it. I started trying to like, yeah, do programming in it, but like I just was not good at it. So I started like doing art. So like, yeah, I naturally like was never that, you know, art inclined really. But you know, I just started doing it and then yeah, kept at it again. But yeah, I definitely, yeah, was loving the flash stuff. I kind of realized quickly, like with a lot of the flash games, you could make, ad revenue with it. Or you could kind of do sponsorships. So yeah, I think a few of these like really crappy things I chucked up online had made like $50 or something. And I was like 16 or something at the time. And I was like, hell yeah, I'm rich. So yeah, I just kept making them. And then yeah, it was going great. I think that was back when like flash games were kind of really at a peak time. So yeah, it was like pretty easy to make money with them.
Yeah. And what led to sort of the formation of Massive Monster as we know it and then starting to make commercial games?
Yeah, so that kind of came out from these flash days. So I made a game with Jay Armstrong, which is one of the other directors in the company. And he had worked on a bunch of other little flash games, but we kind of both had quite a similar style. Like he likes kind of this kind of cute art style, kind of like quite the Behemoth, Castle Crashers kind of look to it. And I was like, this looks great. Like, let's collab. I think I'd put up like a mock-up of, the game I wanted to make, which was, Super Adventure Pals, which was, the first flash game we kind of worked on. And then Chimp, which is one of the other directors in the company, he was also working on a bunch of Flash games. I think he had also done art on a project where Jay had done programming. So, yeah, just kind of, did that for ages. But then, yeah, we hadn't actually ever worked all on a game together until Cult of the Lamb, because Jay kind of did programming for Never Give Up and The Adventure Pals once we kind of moved into console desktop games. And then, yeah, now we're like finally all working together. So that's great.
Yeah. And how was that sort of first experience in developing and releasing a commercial game? Because my first experience with Massive Monster was playing the Adventure Pals at AvCon some years ago, which I was really impressed by with, you know, how you say, you know, very cute and approachable game and one that played. Yeah, it was a really fun platformer sort of game. So what was the experience like creating the Adventure Pals?
It was definitely like a big kind of step up from Flash games. So like I think originally we tried to make it a Flash game, but it just kind of got, the scope of it just got too big. You'd open up Flash and it would just like crash immediately. So yeah, we kind of had to start moving into desktop console. This was around the time of, yeah, the Flash game industry was like dying because all the mobile stuff was coming out. So this was us kind of pivoting to kind of, yeah, get into new markets. But yeah, it was definitely like a long and difficult process trying to like figure out, yeah, how do you even make desktop console games? How do you get on all these platforms? We're kind of using this weird thing called like Hax OpenFL, with Hax like, programming language. OpenFL is like a framework on it. So we're just doing it in a really weird way as well. But I think this was like Unity was pretty early back then as well. But yeah, it's just a lengthy process figuring all that out. But yeah, we kind of got there in the end and it worked out all right. It kind of was, modest success, mainly because, I think there was a lot of luck involved and kind of a big YouTuber covered it and then it was early Switch. So it kind of meant that we could keep doing things. But yeah.
Yeah. And what was it? Never give up. After that, what led to the development of that and how did that go?
Yeah. So that was, I actually didn't have to work on it. So that was great. But that was, Jay and Jim were kind of working on that one. And originally that was a bit of a contract job with Armor Games. So Armor Games were the publisher of The Adventure Pals. And they, again, because they owned a Flash game portal, they were like, oh shit, we need to kind of pivot to different things. So they wanted to jump into desktop console games as well. So, you know, it worked out perfectly. But yeah, they're like, oh, we made this Flash game that like did really well. It had like, I don't know, 20, 30 million plays or something back in the day. So they were like, we need to, yeah, let's make a desktop console version of it. But yeah, it, did not do well. It was like a big flop. I think, the idea itself, like, you know, you already have all these hardcore platforms like Super Meat Boy and all these other things. So yeah, it just didn't really find any grounding in a way where it could like stand out on its own.
Yeah. So with the Adventure Pals and Never Give Up, what were some of the sort of lessons that you learned from that, that you then were able to apply with the development of Cult of the Lamb?
Yeah. I think for me, definitely just kind of like, putting in more consideration for like marketing early on and kind of thinking about, you know, how we're going to sell this game as we in the ideation phase and like just starting with that and then kind of developing on top of it. Just cause yeah, a lot of the struggle we had as well was like, yeah, trying to, how do we sell Adventure Pals and how do we sell Never Give Up? So yeah, really considering that and considering who the audience is and, also on kind of the Adventure Pals, even just because it was so cute and kind of random looking, a lot of people thought it was a kid's game, which is like, you know, fair enough, but it also wasn't really our intention. But you know, it kind of worked out okay because I think we had a lot of parents buying it and kids playing it, which is great. But because it wasn't really what we were thinking when we made him, had him, when we started working on it. So yeah, just kind of, yeah, making sure we consider that stuff and yeah, trying to like do things because we know if we make another flop, we probably won't continue to exist. So actually just making sure we make something that will hopefully sell.
Yeah. And do you feel that as a developer, that pressure when you're developing, you know, say in this instance, Cult of the Lamb, thinking, geez, we need a hit here. Otherwise that's it for our game dev. Do you really feel that quite intently while developing?
I think, our business model has always been in the past, like, relying on publisher funding. So, the idea is, like, hopefully, you know, if it's not a big hit, we can kind of still keep going. But if it is a massive flop, like, you can't never give up. It's, like, there's not really anywhere to go from there because it's, like, published, you know, a publisher probably won't want to work with you again. But, yeah, I think there's definitely that. But I think if you're making – I think there's the pressure is more on just kind of creating a unique idea and not just kind of copying something else or like following the trend. I think that's kind of the pressure for me because, you know, just making sure that we're doing our own thing.
Yeah. And as a lot of people know, Cult of the Lamb does do some very unique and quirky things with genre conventions, which I'll ask about in a sec. But I'd like to first ask, how far back does development of Cult of the Lamb go? Where did the idea first come to you?
Yeah, so I think I keep saying we've worked out for 3 years, but I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, I think we kind of had we kind of got a rough prototype together quite a while ago. I think it was maybe, you know, 6 months after Never Give Up came out, or maybe it was earlier, but we kind of had this rough prototype. I remember I took it to like GDC and was just kind of like, again, throwing the idea out there, just kind of pitching early just to even get an idea of like, you know, are people connecting to what I'm saying? Are they getting excited? And I kind of found from that it was already like too complicated, the ideas we had for it, because it was like, I think the initial idea was called Sky Scouts, and you're on the back of a flying whale and you'd fly around and kind of go down and get resources and hunt stuff and kind of come back up, which isn't too bad. It's, you know, I'm sure that could have done okay as well, but like I was like, we can do better. So yeah, we started basically with that idea of like the two genres kind of mushed together. So with the dungeon crawler with the base builder. So kind of, I think there was a bit of inspiration from games like Moonlighter as well, where they were able to like pull that off in a really, really simple way. Like we knew we could do something kind of similar, but like do it a lot better. You can't take two sides. I think Jay was really interested in exploring kind of like doing a Rimworld thing, but like with actual fun combat where you could like control one of the characters. I think that was his kind of main pull originally. But then, yeah, we were talking, you know, we went through lots of different ideas on how to actually make it work and prototyping and, concepting all these other ideas. I think we kind of stumbled into kind of running a cult through kind of, we were running it, originally you were kind of running a hell, but it was just kind of, it was just kind of sad, like hurting all these followers for no reason. Cause I'm like, if you're running a hell, you kind of need to torture them to like get some juice or get some points from it to fill up your bar. But, it was just me and we're like, no, I don't want to do that. So the cult leader kind of worked perfectly cause you could do it if you wanted to, if you want to be a naughty, if you want to be a bad cult leader, or you could be nice to them and, you know, you could do both really. And it just kind of like, it was more exciting for us as well. I think when we started going down the cult route, like it kind of was writing itself a bit more, which is, it's usually a good indication if an idea is working, if you can kind of come up with the ideas easily.
Yeah. And as creative director, what did your role involve or entail with Cult of the Lamb?
Yeah, it's been a funny one actually, because like, this is the first game I've done a lot of programming on this game as well. But I don't know. I like to say that I kind of try and steer the ship a little bit, like in the directions we're going with it. I think early on, my role was like, exploring the art style, trying to get the look of it down, like not too focused on what an individual asset looks like, but more like, what's the general look of this? What kind of lighting are we bringing to it? How can we make this stand out? So kind of, exploring shaders and a lot of that stuff as well. A lot of just kind of working with Jay and the others on kind of like game design things and trying to keep them on track with kind of this cult idea and kind of getting the tone right. I've managed to get away with, not doing, heaps on it, I think. Like, but it's kind of funny. I look back, I'm like, what did I actually do on it? But, cause I know, like, Jim, the other art director, he pumped out so much art assets and kind of did heaps of animation for it. I was just mumbling around steering a ship. I don't know.
Well, one thing I'm curious about going back to the core concept of that, you know, action roguelike with the colony base management aspect of Cult of the Lamb. One thing that I found in my time with the game that I've really enjoyed is how well each of those seemingly separate elements feed into one another and inform one another and keep this really satisfying gameplay loop going pretty well the entire time you're playing. And it's such a cohesive experience, despite on paper sounding like a very, very odd mix of things. So I'm curious, obviously there was lots of play testing and iteration involved, but what led you to find that really good mix of the gameplay elements to create what we see now?
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, it, yeah, as you say, it took a lot of iteration and it probably didn't come together until like 6 months ago. It was just a lot of, we knew the biggest thing for the game was we needed like those loops to keep feeding into each other and never feel like one-sided. So yeah, a lot of the work around the gameplay was trying to improve that. And the kind of what I say is like the glue that kind of kept it all together, I think, is the followers, because it's all kind of like led through the followers where you're kind of doing tasks for them, you're looking after them, but you're also trying to kind of get more powerful through them. So you kind of, and just kind of whenever you finish one thing that you're doing, there's kind of a new thing that's going to pop up that you're like, oh, maybe I should do that. Like you're trying to quit the game, but it's like, oh, I need to do that before I get off. Oh, I haven't done my sermon yet. Oh, but now this guy needs some, you know, this guy's hungry. So it's like, oh, it just like keeps going into each other where the game's telling you like, okay, you know, go from the base now. You need to go get some resources or something. You need some new followers. I think it came together by adding a lot of things as well. Just kind of all these systems that you can kind of unlock. And yeah, it ended up with like a ton of systems in the game, and that was like super overwhelming as well. Once we added all those in, we're like, oh, this is great. But it's like, there's so much stuff going on. So that's why like you don't even get all the systems until like 2 hours into the game or something.
Yeah, I was really impressed by the tutorialization of the game. It didn't feel overwhelming, and that all of those systems were drip fed at a really steady rate so that you didn't feel like you ran out of things to do, but it didn't overwhelm you with you know, systems right from the get-go. Can you think of any examples during development and perhaps leading up to the period of 6 months ago where you said things started to really come together? Can you think of any examples during development where, say, some of those systems weren't working and you can think of a particular moment where you managed to solve, you know, an issue of bringing it together?
Yeah, well, I think... Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because just a lot of the systems didn't work properly. And when you're kind of making a systems-based game, which kind of the base side is, and even, I guess, because it's so connected to the dungeon, it all kind of is, it's hard for it all to come together until you've got all the pieces there. So there was quite a few times where, like, I'm trying to think of some specific examples. Even like, I feel like the sermons and rituals, like it was really hard for us to like justify them originally. And we were kind of like, we had them in there, but they weren't really doing much. But yeah, we kind of had those pieces there. But then once we added all these other pieces, like, yeah, the player upgrade tree and stuff like that, then we're like, oh, okay, we can bring that into this. And kind of the other pieces started making sense. So kind of just, yeah, getting all those pieces together and then, yeah, make a little puzzle out of it, I guess. I'm trying to think of more other examples. We just tried out lots of ideas. It just didn't work. Like, you used to have to give, like, offerings to the one who waits every X amount of days. And there used to be this big giant head that would chase you around the dungeon if you're in it too long, because the players were spending too long in the dungeons. And so many things. But, yeah, it's just... yeah, I don't know. It's all a blur now. Just erased the last 3 years from my brain.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And with you mentioned the inspirations included the likes of Moonlighter and RimWorld from video games. What other inspirations or other mediums inspired Cult of the Lamb along the way?
Yeah, I mean, so I really wanted to bring in, quite a few. I wanted to bring a lot of non-game stuff into this game. So, like, I really love horror films. I really, you know, I mean, a classic example of it is, yeah, Midsommar. You get that quite a bit in the base side of the game. But then, you know, Hereditary, a lot of these, yeah, really crazy horror films where they're even just, like, where they use lighting a lot. I think Suspiria, they are really, like, push the lighting. You're like, whoa, like, they'll just make the whole screen red. And I'm like, okay, I really want to bring a lot of this influence from, like, horror films, how they kind of make things look kind of scary or kind of really push the direction and bring that into the game. And then along similar things with, yeah, kind of the cartoon style. I want it to be cartoon, but I wanted it to feel more mature. So things like Over the Garden Wall, where it is, like, you know, things are cute, but it's also quite like a disturbing world. And you're like, what the hell's going on in here? So yeah, I think kind of pulling from those mediums, really helped.
And it looks like your, commitment to lighting extends to the real world as well. Cause I've seen, a lot of the interviews and even now you've got this nice red sort of color grading. It's very, very, very intentional. I take it with your cinematic, camera lighting.
Oh, that's it. I mean, I just love lighting. Like I throw parties every now and then. And, I basically put, it'll be a few weeks of prep, just getting all these, a little lighting installation going and playing around with kind of Arduinos and setting up my own kind of lighting stuff for them. But I actually need to set up some RGB lighting for the keyboards and stuff. I think we've been sent a few keyboards to do that. So just been lazy.
Very good. So how did the partnership with Devolver come about? Because clearly they're such a well-known label in the indie space, and I imagine quite a sought-after partnership. So how did this eventuate?
Yeah, so I think it was something we definitely had in the back of our mind as we were kind of creating the idea of the game as well. But I think Jay had maybe met with one of the people through, he won like a Breakthrough Brit thing or something where he could, they kind of put him in touch with some industry people. So I think he had like maybe met a Devolver person and we kind of knew in the back of our mind, like, ooh, there might be a possibility for us to kind of hit them up when we get something ready to pitch. I don't think he got his contact information though, so he just guessed it, but I think it was the correct email. But yeah, we kind of, knowing that, yeah, we're going for Devolver, we're like, we can kind of double down on like the cult stuff and the occult stuff. They're, you know, Devolver's quite, I don't know, punkish or, you know, alternative-ish. So I think they'd be into something a bit fucked up or something. So we can, so I think that definitely helped and it meant we didn't have to worry too much with the direction we're going. But yeah, they were kind of keen. We talked to heaps of publishers actually, and it was the first time where, yeah, like everyone we're talking to was like keen, and we're like, oh, okay. This is new. But yeah, Devolver were just kind of like, they were our ideal publisher, and they were very much just like, yep, we like it. Let's get signed, get going straight away. Where I think some of the other publishers were like, you know, making us go through hoops, like, oh yeah, we'll do some due diligence on you guys. And we're like, we're just three guys working remotely. We don't really want some due diligence done. Like, you know, just have to roll the dice on us really. So yeah, it worked out well. And they've been really great to work with. Like just the amount of work just publishing the game that they do is crazy.
And from a local development scene, I know there was a recent event hosted by Vic Screen, which Cult of the Lamb was a focal point of a local project on the big stage and showcasing the local dev scene. So what support did you receive from Vic Screen or any local agencies?
Yeah, so basically that was when we had this rough demo. We kind of had the rough demo and we kind of started packaging it together a little bit, but we knew it wasn't really at the quality level we wanted to like pitch to publishers because, you know, we got to make a good impression. So we basically got them to give us a small amount of funding. I think it's only about $40,000 Australian, but kind of it meant that we could really really kind of polish up that demo, and we're trying to get to like more of a vertical slice with it. But yeah, just really make it as good as we can. We got like our composer on it, making sure that, yeah, he could get a bunch of tracks done, and we got some like key art stuff done for it. So just, yeah, took it to the next level. And then when we did start pitching out, I think that definitely kind of helped, because it showed already that we had a really high quality level for it.
Yeah, certainly. And on a personal level, speaking to the last week, well, it's not even been a full week yet since The Cult of the Lamb has launched. But let me just throw a figure at you at the moment. Over 11,500 Steam user reviews in less than a week. Could you have possibly, in your wildest dreams, anticipated such a response to Cult of the Lamb?
No. Yeah, honestly, I don't think so. I think, like, we had decent hopes that, yeah, we'd do it. But, like, yeah, it's just kind of, as I said, it's just kind of exceeded that point now. So, anything beyond that, I'm just like, well, it's still going. It's still going up. That's crazy. I don't know what to say. But, yeah, I think we've just been quite... I feel like it hasn't sunk in too much yet. Like, we've been just trying to fix bugs for people and really been like on it to try and help people that are having any difficulties with it. So we're kind of haven't been able to like sit down and enjoy it too much yet, just because we're like, yeah, we want to get these fixes in as soon as possible. And I think it's just kind of, it's really hard because it's like, yeah, when you just get to this scale of people playing the game, there's just so many things that you wouldn't have, like, QA couldn't find, just because there's just so many people playing it. So yeah, we're just on it at the moment, getting those buggy boys done.
It's a nice problem to have, to have so many people playing it that they're picking up things that QA couldn't
so
pick
annoying.
Up. One thing out of curiosity, I was just having a look at some of Devolver's previously published titles, and one that I think of was last year's Death's Door, which was one of the indie games of last year. Cult of the Lamb has already surpassed the user review count there, which is just crazy to think about.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, sick. Because I know Cult of the Lamb has a roadmap planned and future content planned and that sort of thing. But does the sheer, ironically, cult-like response to the game inform or change your future plans in terms of, will you be doing more on it, or will it allow you to move on to the next thing quicker? How does this level of success impact you as a developer?
I think, you know, we definitely like to have a lot of kind of control over our games and stuff. So I don't think we'll ever kind of grow too big, because we want to be able to kind of, you know, have that direction and kind of make sure everything's at the quality level we want. But it's just meant that we can kind of, yeah, we can reinvest a lot of that into the game and kind of make it the best it can. So trying to get like 60 FPS on Switch or something, for example, kind of aiming to really, yeah, get someone who just knows their shit in to kind of really optimize the hell out of it, and just kind of, yeah, making sure it kind of has the chance to be the best game it can without kind of being limited. So we can just throw a bunch of money at it, is what I'm saying. But yeah, we'll continue. I think like the idea was always with it, like, we'll continue to update it if people keep buying it. So yeah, we'll we've definitely got like plans to keep working on the game and kind of even looking at ways we can expand the IP, be it a board game or kind of mobile game of Knucklebones or something, I don't know. So yeah, lots of, it's a very exciting time for us, and yeah, we'll, it's gonna be good.
Yeah, indeed. One thing I'm curious about with the future updates with Cult of the Lamb, what are you able to share at the moment in terms of sort of future plans for the game?
We haven't announced too much yet, but the kind of definitely the plan from us at the moment is the first update being a lot more of a kind of quality of life improvement. So just kind of really making sure that, yeah, players can kind of continue. There's more kind of players can kind of continue to play it. We've maybe added a bit more kind of layers and content, and just kind of making sure that base game is like as solid as it can be. And then kind of from there, we'll kind of aim at, yeah, doing more kind of content driven and kind of fun updates, I guess, where, yeah, we'll just do whatever we want. Should, we've definitely got a few ideas going. But yeah, they'll all be, we kind of plan, yeah, we're planning at the moment to just release them all for free, at least for like, yeah, probably the first year, and just kind of, yeah, just make sure, keep the, you know, the followers happy. Don't want any, you know, anyone rebelling against us.
No dissenters.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic. I look forward to seeing it all then. So one question I like to close things out with guests, and some take this rather philosophically, some Ooh. Take it more well, literally. some, you know, like to have a bit of fun with it. I'm curious, Julian, why should people care about video games?
Whoa. I mean, that is it's a good question. And when I saw you were going to ask that, I was like, oh shit. But I think, I don't know, for me, it's hard because I actually don't play games that often. Like, and I, you know, I've been meaning to, and I love games, but I'm just really behind on them. But I think like they are probably one of the mediums where there's just, like, it's just so much creativity that is taken to kind of push out a game where you got art direction, you've got all the music, you've got, yeah, all the game design. Like, I don't know if there's any other medium that requires so much input from like different mediums. I mean, you got movies and stuff as well, but it's like that level of interactivity and creativity is, really, yeah, it's unmatched. I think as well with like, just being such small teams that you can get away with, like, yeah, these giant successes that something like a movie couldn't, where it's a much more kind of catered and authored experience in the kind of creative output.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.